Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
One of Kenny's claims to fame is the fact that he would do aggravated burglaries on drug dealers' houses and steal their drugs and their money. So he said, when I do my run-throughs, I get nervous beforehand, so I have to back one out. So they said, okay, we'll leave that there, thanks very much. Although we do have a photo of him holding it up, smiling.
Hello, Australian true crime listeners. That is the voice of legendary homicide detective Roland Legg. As I know you know, our podcast is based in Melbourne, which became the world's most locked-down city at some stage last year. I can't remember exactly when, because I was trying not to keep track of such depressing developments by then. But in and around all of our lockdowns and restrictions, we had one little live show that kept being postponed. Roland Legg was standing by to be our special guest for that show. Well, it's finally happening at the Yarraville Club on April 8. That's just a couple of weeks away, and thanks to the end of restrictions, we've even been allowed to release more tickets. So there's a link in the show notes to this episode and also on our Facebook page, or you can just Google Australian True Crime Yarraville Club, that'll work as well, and we would love to see you there. Emily and I will be on stage with Roland, and you can ask him questions right there in the room and he will answer them. You can also buy our books and get them signed, and we'll just be very, very happy to be out of the house. So that's all very good news. And in other good news, Roland Legg is our guest on the show this week. And we begin with a bit of background into the early days of his stunning career. By the end of his career, Roland Legg was one of five senior homicide detectives who'd led the squad through some of the most notorious cases in Australian history, along with Ron Idles, Charlie Bazina, Jeff Marr, and Lucio Rovis. It was Roland who had the responsibility of investigating the Melbourne gang murders, the Frankston serial killer, notorious underworld figures like Christopher Dale Flannery, also known as Mr. Rent-A-Kill, whose many hits they investigated, before ultimately having to investigate his own murder. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Roland was the lead investigator on the Jaden Lesky case, spending months in the Victorian town of Moe, at first searching for the missing 18-month-old boy who'd been left in the care of his mother's boyfriend, before sadly being called to Blue Rock Dam the day his little body was found. To this day, no one's been convicted of little Jaden's murder. I often think of that case as the kind that would break many coppers, but Roland Legg is made of sterner stuff. He's the personification of old school. Interestingly, though, he doesn't reckon he was a born copper, although I would argue that events have always nudged him in that direction.
I had no inclination to become a policeman at primary school or even early secondary school, but I grew up in East Hawthorne. Our neighbour over the back fence, who was he and his wife are very close friends of my parents, Harry Pascoe, who's the longest serving coroner, lived over the back fence, and he, his son and I were great mates. The Camberwell tram depot wasn't far away, and there was a house rented a few blocks from where we lived by a tram driver and his conductress wife. Anyway, she was having a bit of a philander with someone else at the Camberwell tram depot, and ultimately her husband was killed and from memory dismembered. And there, in that area there were a lot of quarries where bricks were manufactured in East Hawthorne. There's a lot of clay. So there was a quarry just up from the Southeastern Freeway on Toorak Road, which is now a park, on the corner of, I think it's Elizabeth Street. Anyway, the from memory, the tram driver, the husband, was in a suitcase or a box of some description deposited in the quarry, which is now a park. So that happened nearby.
And these are the sorts of stories you were overhearing, little ears flapping at neighbourhood barbecues. The coroner was there and he was inviting his workmates, who were detectives, coppers.
Yes, yes. I wasn't aware of the detail of it at that time, of course, but I understand there'd be a few old Falcons and Studi Bakers parked at the barbecues. I remember one hot night we were at his barbecue, and or a barbecue, and no doubt there were a lot of police there I wasn't aware of, but he had it. He asked a couple of the police wrestlers to come along, and anyway,
I didn't know there was such thing as police wrestlers.
Well, there were then.
A team?
I think there was a wrestling club or something. Oh. But anyway, I remember these blokes that were said to be policemen, and they were wrestling in his front garden. He had a high fence, and it was on the corner of Taronga Road and Pleasant Road in East Hawthorne. And I can remember them having a bit of a wrestle, and it was all a bit of fun and something different to watch. Mm. Anyway, then this fellow popped up, and one of these wrestlers was put with his heels on one chair and his tip of his back of his head on another chair, and a chair under his bottom. And this hypnotist appeared, supposedly, and pulled the chair out, and this bloke was like a board with his heels and his head. Anyway, I go to a lot of old hack lunches, and there's an ex-homicide detective who was there with Mick Miller and other names in the 60s, long before my time. And he knew Harry Pascoe very well. And I think he'd be 92 now, this fellow. He comes regularly. And we were reminiscing one day about the Pascoe family, and he, unbeknown to me until shortly before this, he'd known them very well, and I didn't realise. Anyway, I said, telling him the same story about these barbecues and the hypnotism. He said, I was the hypnotist.
No!
So that would have been about 1966 or something.
God,
I said,
isn't that wonderful?
I imagine there would have been a bit of beer flowing at those barbies.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm sure there was. Sure there was. Harry enjoyed a drink. But he's a great man, great guy.
Now we've got half a dozen coroners
yes.
as well.
Well, it's the same if you look back to what were known as the police surgeons. I mean, people like John Birrell and Peter Bush were were one-man bands, whereas now there's a cast of thousands.
So they were like the forensic pathologists of their day. Is that what you mean?
No, they weren't pathologists. They were the doctors who would go and examine rape victims and and certify.
Or like serious assaults
people
and stuff like that?
How would they get all that work done if you're just one
well,
person?
Well, of course, I suppose the population was less then, and I think they had the occasional assistant, but they certainly didn't have the numbers that we have now. In the 60s and 50s and 60s when I was growing up, we didn't have fluoride in the water, and so kids used to have more fillings than they have now. And I can remember going for a filling, I think it was late in primary school from memory, and our dentist was opposite that Camberwell, famous place, the Camberwell Tram Depot, and I went to have a filling. His wife had a dental surgery in one front room, and he was in the other front room, and the residence was at the back. And in fact, I think I used to go to Cubs with his son, or I did go to Cubs with his son. They had a son and a daughter. Anyway, this week I... on the Tuesday or Wednesday, went to the dentist and had a filling, and we're listening to the radio over breakfast the following Saturday morning, and we sort of guessed who it was and what was going on. But on the Friday night, the dentist killed his wife and his two children with an axe and a mattock, and stuck his head in the gas oven and killed himself, which gives you a bit of an strange feeling in the mouth when you know that he was doing all sorts of digging and stabbing in your mouth a couple of days before.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
Mm. And you knew his son too, like, because you did the Cubs.
So that was another sort of strange pre-policing connection that was a bit weird.
And your wife moved into a murder scene?
Oh, God. Yes, well, my
wife... It was no longer an active murder scene, I should point out.
Long before I met her, and I met her after I joined the police force, but her father was an Anglican minister, Anglican vicar at All Saints Kooyong, which is opposite Scotch College on Glenfrey Road, and the vicarage was in Wellesley Road, which is also off Glenfrey Road, and I can remember at primary school, at Ormond South Primary School that I used to attend at that time, it all being on the news that the vicar's mother, with whom he lived at the vicarage, was murdered by a fellow who was ultimately incarcerated at the governor's pleasure. But he tortured her horrifically and killed the vicar's wife. And my wife and her family were the next family into the vicarage after the after the murder, and the Reverend Hall left. So, yes, strange occurrences looking back.
I mean, what it also reminds me of, though, is how much a part of life and the suburbs and normal people's lives violent crime is, really, and that must be something that you've found then in your career as a homicide detective, and something that other detectives have said to us, that it's normal people generally. I mean, I believe that was actually a random attack, that one in the vicarage, wasn't it? She didn't know her attacker in that case.
No, that's correct.
But generally, the others that you've spoken of are family attacks, partner attacks. It is something that happens in the suburbs, as we always say.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Exactly. It can happen anywhere. And it's just a bit out of the ordinary that, although I wasn't directly exposed to any of these things, that they were happening closely around me in view of, the occupation that I ultimately took up.
Yeah. So when did you start to think about the coppers as a lifestyle?
Oh, probably my mid-teens. I wanted to be an architect. In my mid-teens, I don't know, I just became more and more interested in it, much to the horror of my parents.
What was it in particular you think that piqued your interest with being a cop?
Oh, I suppose this interest in crime, not so much to do with the matters that I've discussed, but I suppose that focused me a little more on it. But it probably not a fascination, but certainly an interest, you know, in crime programs and crime stories and that sort of thing. I just developed more of an interest, and it just took precedence. And ultimately it was all I wanted to do. And all I wanted to do in the police force was really to be a detective. I was never interested in the traffic side of things, but always interested in the criminal investigation work. And I suppose a lot of people have an ambition to go to the homicide squad because it's the ultimate crime. But some people who are very capable detectives say that it's the last place they want to go to. But we're all different.
Yeah, because once you became interested, you were laser-focused, weren't you?
Mm.
I spoke to you for my book, and I remember asking you at one point about attending scenes, because I know that you oftentimes volunteered, for example, to attend autopsies of children and things of that nature in the place of other detectives who had young children themselves. And you said to me, well, when you are passionate about your work, you will accept certain things that are difficult if you're really passionate about what you're doing. And I've just found that really inspiring. Obviously, I don't do that work, but I've just found that a really inspiring sentiment.
It wasn't a regular occurrence, but particularly when someone is new there, I suppose. And it's probably more so when I was in charge of a crew. And it wasn't something that was, as I said, regular. But particularly if someone was new, the attending an autopsy is unpleasant anyway. But as you would be aware, the homicide squad attends every autopsy in a suspicious death or what was clearly a murder. And sometimes, but when someone starts at the squad and isn't used to that, it can be difficult, and they sometimes have to be carefully introduced to it. But also, naturally, if on top of that they have young children, then it makes it more disturbing. You know, some people just decide, and it's not a regular occurrence, but some people decide that they just can't take it for long periods.
Mm. And that's an extreme example, but I think it's an example of your attitude in general that, well, if you want something badly enough, you'll accept the hard bits, the ugly bits.
Well, you look at it, your mind is on the professional side of it rather than the unpleasant side of it, and you can't dismiss the unpleasant side totally. But you're there for a reason. It's part of the job, and so you're focused on exactly what is being discovered. That having been at the scene when sometimes the pathologist hasn't, just conferring with him the whole time, giving him background to help him with what he's doing. And of course, to identify things like the angles of wounds and the recovery of projectiles, or you know, and the type of weapon that's used. Often, if we needed an autopsy done fairly quickly, knives involved, perhaps, then you would take. The knife would be photographed and forensically examined at the scene, and whoever was doing the autopsy would take the knife for the pathologist to look at it at the autopsy. But it's a lot more, and I think I probably covered this with your book. It's although it's still unpleasant, it's a lot more comfortable at an autopsy these days to what it was at the old mortuary in Flinders Street Extension. These days, you're seated on a high chair, looking through glass with an intercom to the pathologist. But in those days, you were sitting on a wooden stool beside the trolley, and maybe have six or seven bodies lined up, one of which was the victim of your murder. So it's a lot more comfortable these days.
You described that place as a house of horrors, the Flinders Street Extension.
Yes, well, of course, there's a mixture of things, not only what you can see, but sometimes things are a little more rough and ready than they are now. It's all much more refined and professional than it used to be. And often bodies of all descriptions have been in situ for various periods of time before they're removed and from a scene or a creek or whatever. And, the smell of rotting flesh is not terribly pleasant either.
Thank you to patrons Gina, Sue Domsalar, Matilda Steelcliffe, Paul 85, Vivian Compton, Leah Sabree, Kerry Winchcombe, Danielle Annenson, Stacey Nansen, and Joel Puckridge.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, find out which notorious Australian criminal featured on the invitation to Roland's retirement party, in a party hat, no less. But first, there's been a change at the Police Academy in recent years that a lot of older and former members struggle with. A certain rite of passage that was a compulsory part of basic training is no longer compulsory. Roland has thoughts, and I dare say you will too.
I think it's a retrograde step. My understanding is, recently anyway, I'm assuming it's still the case, that recruits don't attend autopsies.
It's not compulsory. They can opt in now. Whereas, well, back in Roland's day, not only was the mortuary very vastly different situation, but every recruit as part of their training had their day where they got on the bus and they went and watched an autopsy, whereas now it's an opt-in.
Well, I thought, honestly, it would just still be part of the training.
No, it's very controversial with the older
interesting
police, yeah.
Well, the last thing you want at a fatal accident or the scene of a suspicious death or a murder or whatever, is one of the police members collapsing. There were quite often collapses at the old mortuary when the recruits walked in to watch their first autopsy. And you can imagine it's a fairly, like with a doctor or a nurse, it's a pretty daunting sort of experience. But it's better that people are collapsing at the mortuary than in the middle of the street. And apart from the embarrassment of it, it you know, they have a job to do, and it's a tough job. Mm. And you know, I'm not being dismissive of people's feelings, but if you can't do it, then you know, don't do it. I can remember when I was first a senior detective at the homicide squad, we had a young girl who was raped and murdered and dropped down a chute at the Elizabeth Street Housing Commission flats. And I was going down to do to watch the autopsy. And another detective at the squad, who hadn't been there very long, I can't remember whether he felt like fainting or he had fainted at an autopsy, but he was affected very adversely, which is, you know, nothing to be embarrassed about. And he came over to me and said, "Can I come with you?" He said, "I want to stay here and I'm going to have to crack hardy. And, you know, the way I'm going to do it, I'm going to have to bite the bullet and do it." Yeah. And so he came and he was fine. But the police have a job to do and certainly get used to what you're doing, but you just can't be catering. You can't be catering too much. You take people's feelings into consideration and you help them, and maybe you protect them from certain things and let them slowly become accustomed to something, but they can't be hidden away. I remember one Easter that we were called out. This is when I was in charge of a crew, and a woman and her teenage daughter had been found deceased in a bed, in the mother's double bed, and they were in a reasonably advanced state of decomposition. They'd been there for a while, and so the uniformed police attended. They were covered up, so they didn't want to disturb it too much. Then the local detectives attended, and then they called us. So we wandered out there and wandered into the bedroom. And when I wandered in, it was, I won't go into details, but as we were talking about before, with the most unpleasant, pungent odour of decomposing flesh and blowflies and all the rest. And anyway, when we, without disturbing too much, had a look under the bedclothes, and we then found a suicide note signed by both of them beside them. And I went out to the detectives and I said, "Well, what are we doing here? There's enough in the house to identify the writing, and there'd been a bit of history that may not, that would indicate that what had happened was not an enormous shock." And they said, "Oh, we just couldn't stand the smell."
I was going to ask you about that, yeah, because I've heard some complaints along the lines of scenes not being processed thoroughly enough to the standard that detectives would like, because the attending officers were squeamish, basically.
Mm. I mean, we're more than... we have the added resources that were at our disposal, and the expertise. We've seen a lot of scenes and bodies at scenes that you'd swear was a murder, and ultimately there was an explanation for it, and it might have been a suicide or natural causes or whatever. And it gets back to police being exposed to as much as possible during their training, that they have a job to do, and if they've done everything they possibly can and they think, "Well, I'm not terribly happy with this," then by all means call in the detectives. And if they're not too happy with this, by all means call in the homicide squad. But don't have a gaze at a distance and for one reason or another say, "I'll leave this to someone else."
No, because then on the other hand, we've got so many cases building up on detectives' desks and families phoning and saying, "What's happening? Why isn't anything happening?" or whatever. You don't have time, frankly.
Well, what happened was that that Easter, what happened in those days when I was in charge of a crew, there'd be an on-call crew, a backup crew and a third crew. It was Easter. A lot of people were away. I used to do the roster, so people would have their requests for, you know, this is for all the crews, and so you'd try to have those that were free.
School holidays, the wives are up them saying, "I want to go away."
Due for a bit of a break, they might have had a heart slog. "Look, I've been on call Christmas. Can I have Easter off or something?" Anyway, that Easter, The on-call crew, the backup crew and the third crew were all called out. For memory, one or two were in the country because we covered the whole of Victoria. They still cover the whole of Victoria from Melbourne. Now, my crew weren't on-call one, on-call two or on-call three. I was able to scratch enough together to go out when I got the call saying the on-call crews are totally committed. Can you scratch a few on your crew together to go and do this? So I think we ended up with five being called out.
Wow.
Over that weekend. So that added to the fact that we were called out unnecessarily.
I wouldn't like to be those attending officers who hadn't had a look because they didn't like the smell.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a gentle reminder, but nothing too serious. But
I would feel that if I was going to become a police officer, I would want to see all that stuff and do that because, yeah, like what's the point of being a cop if you can't?
Well, you think you wouldn't want to see it for the first time at a traffic accident
or
something like that.
I feel like, and just to have that mentorship and having things explained. But I honestly thought that was just part and parcel of being at the academy where you go to an autopsy.
It was in your day, wasn't it, Roland?
Well, I think it should be exposed. And I'm not dismissing people's feelings and sensitivities, but it's a job where certain things are required. If you don't like the sight of blood, then you either get used to it,
yeah,
or you find another job, or you become a desk hugger for your career. But if it's fair enough, some people can't handle it. As I said, there are some people who are the most competent investigators, but they just can't put up with or don't think that they'd be able to put up with the gruesome homicide investigation day after day and distraught relatives day after day, which is fine. We're all different.
Yeah, most of us probably couldn't.
But if you can't handle a dead body or the sight of blood or something, then perhaps policing is not for you.
Yeah.
Because it's quite likely you are at some stage going to encounter that maybe a few times.
It makes you wonder what it is about policing that people are interested in if they don't want to go to the...
Well, I gave that example before of the detective when I was a senior detective at the squad asking to come to what was going to be a very unpleasant autopsy because he was just so keen to stay to do the job and he didn't have another moment's problem for the whole time he was there. But he just thought to himself, well, I'm going to have to crack hardy here and this is the way to do it, which is a pretty tough decision.
It is.
He knew that there was no place to hide.
Yep, and he was passionate
if you want, and absolutely,
about the work. And
absolutely.
He knew that he had to, you know, find a way to overcome that bit of it because it is a fairly small part of it, isn't it, in terms of time. I'm sure in terms of mental and emotional energy it's a big part of it. But in terms of the overall job, it's...
Well, Every job you get is going to involve either a body or an injury, the person who has the potential that they're going to die. And every death requires an autopsy, and every autopsy requires at least one homicide detective to be present.
Okay, so it's only homicide detectives. It's not like you could have another kind of police officer at an autopsy as well, just to observe it.
If for instance, we had a murder in regional Victoria and the body was being brought to Melbourne for the autopsy and the whole crew was investigating it in Wangaratta or Mildura or somewhere, then... you would get onto the office and say, I need someone to attend the autopsy. I'd give the briefing to that person so they knew the background of what had occurred and maybe have a conference with the pathologist beforehand. But it would be a homicide squad detective who would be at the autopsy.
What can you tell us about your time at the academy? What do you remember about that?
Well, I started my training at what was called the Police Depot, which is now, I think, a music school.
How old were you?
19. Mm. Just turned 19, I think, yes. So I had my my first, I think, 3 months there. And we'd run around the tan and swim in the Olympic pool and in our fatigues. And then we were one of the first squads into Glen Waverley when it opened, the place on the hill. But in those days, after the Roman Catholic Church moved out, I think the only building was the old cream brick towered building, and then there were just some wooden sheds and buildings spread around that we'd do some of our training in, pretend scenes of this and scenes of that. I can remember sewage leaking onto the Oval when we were doing our press-ups. I can remember blowflies and snails in the cabbage and the lettuce. We used to, in those days there wasn't a pool, of course, and we used to swim and do our life-saving at a boys' home in Tally Ho. And we were told on one occasion that it had been discovered that a couple of the boys at the boys' home were urinating in the pool when they knew the police were coming.
Okay.
So that was all pretty comforting too. So it was pretty... it was a harder slog, I think, than it is now. And
no opting in or out.
No, and no head patting and bum rubbing from the instructors either. If if you're having a bad day, and one of some of the stories that I've heard in recent years, everything's become more politically correct. But you did the wrong thing, or you weren't trying hard enough, and you knew all about it.
Yeah, yep. So it was only 3 months.
It was more like the army, I think, then. Than
yeah. Was it only 3 months, did you say?
20 weeks, I think it was.
Wow. And then did everyone go to Russell Street, was that?
Yes, in those days we did.
To HQ.
Yeah, everybody would go to either Russell Street Police Station or to what was called then City Traffic. So in those days, as a lot of older people remember, on all the main intersections, there'd be a couple of policemen there all day and into the night directing the traffic with those white sleeves on. And, and that was City Traffic that was based, I think, in Elizabeth Street in those days.
Seen those pictures of the sleeves.
I've seen
the
it
sleeves.
Happen again, like in the last couple of years, just for like a day or so, they'll get the young recruits out and make them direct traffic.
They still do the training for directing traffic. They were basically, we at Russell Street would do the, I was there for 6 months before I transferred for the first time, but we would do the foot patrols 24 hours a day, the Bourke Street patrol, two of us, or the Swanston Street patrol or whatever. We'd walk around, one up, would walk around Parliament House 24 hours a day. And if you weren't at a specific spot when the duty officer came, you got a slap on the wrist. You had to be time everywhere you walked around Parliament House. Then the forensic laboratory was on the corner of Spring Street and Little Bourke Street. So another one of the duties for the Russell Street Police would be manning the switchboard there after hours, one of those old cord-inserting switchboards. But now, of course, they're out at McLeod. There are all sorts of duties that they would do.
And then at the end of that, you start to put in for where you want to go, don't you? And you hope that you get where you want to go.
Yes.
Where did you put in for?
I put in for Camberwell originally. I ultimately wanted to go to an inner suburban police station, but it was not far from where I had grew up, so it was familiar to me. So I went there for a couple of years. And in fact, I was My great claim to fame is that I was the last policeman to direct the traffic at Camberwell Junction the day the lights went on.
I don't know if that is your great claim to fame, frankly, so that, but maybe your first one.
There'd be people who couldn't imagine Camberwell Junction without traffic lights.
Oh my
but,
God.
No, I did the last day, the day that traffic lights went on.
Oh.
But, that was interesting. We'd had to go down there every morning and night, and if we got there a few minutes late in the morning or in the evening peak, it was like a jigsaw puzzle. You'd have to be crawling across bonnets of some of the cars to be moving them a few inches here and a few inches there, with the morons that were driving them, not foreseeing what was about to occur. But so that was interesting. We a couple of the guys, fortunately not myself, but a couple collapsed there because a couple of the roads there, Burke Road and Riversdale Road, particularly. Come down into a sort of a basin, and the fumes would build up on a hot day. With all the fumes, and a couple collapsed there. The worst that happened, I stood there a few days in ankle deep water. That was as uncomfortable as became for me. But we used to have those capes, and in the summer we would we'd have the as they called us roofing nails, the old white helmets, but. Yeah, a few near misses. The old trams fortunately had running boards, but I can remember one day that it was a bit windy, cold, blowy, wet morning, and I was down there in my cape, and the old trams had the running boards and those metal advertising things on the side, and one of the advertising metal sheets had bent and come loose, and it caught my cape. And fortunately, I felt it pull and saw what happened and leapt onto the running board. And there's a pedestrian crossing on Burke Road heading north. And I think it took me until that pedestrian crossing to unhook my cape and run back to the middle of the intersection.
But yeah, it sounds like it could have ripped your head off.
Well, actually, I thought, that's a bit of a near miss. But there was a very sad situation that happened around the same time. And I... because what would happen, and the reason you're so close to the tram, is that in those days, and of course those running boards protruded, but in those days the trams on Riversdale Road and Burke Road would pass each side of you. So you were between, about 3 inches each.
God.
So between you and the running boards, if both trams passed you at the same time. And there was a very, around the time that I had my hookup with my cape, very sadly, a city traffic policeman in a similar position in the city was hit by a tram when they were passing him both ways. And in fact, he never recovered.
No, I can't imagine.
He died a couple of years ago, I think, very sadly. It's my vintage. But it was a result mainly of his situation where he came off far worse than me, obviously. The instruction was the trams weren't permitted to pass each side of the policeman, that if they're approaching at the same time, then one had to stop until the other one had passed through.
So dangerous. It always amazes me in Australia now we have so many rules and people say we're a nanny state and all that, which I agree with to a certain extent. But then you think it was so recently that we were as loose as that. We wouldn't allow policemen to stand in the middle of an intersection with 6 inches grace between two moving trams every day.
It sounds so stressful too, directing traffic, how you describe it. I think I would be better attending, autopsies than actually. That would stress me out more doing traffic.
Oh, it's all part of life's rich tapestry. You look back and say, that was a bit of fun at times.
Yeah.
But, some mornings you go down there and it was a bit of fun. You'd be wondering what was going to happen. I remember a tram actually did almost run the policeman over.
Mm.
And he chased it along Camberwell Road, blowing his whistle, and dragged the driver out and dragged him up the police station, left the tram in the middle of Camberwell Road.
No.
That caused a bit of a flurry at the local depot.
I mean, the whistles, I just imagined. Do police have whistles anymore?
Probably not.
No, okay.
But we all had them, like the old umpire whistles on the fingers and blew them to remind someone that they weren't allowed to turn right or they weren't allowed to do this or do that.
But, well, that you were coming.
But, no, it was a bit of fun, something different.
Yeah.
But
didn't you go into
when
homicide
it wasn't
really,
raining.
Didn't you go into homicide really young for some reason, your first stint?
Yes, after my couple of years at Campbell, I was at Paran for a couple of years at the old Greville Street police station, and that's where I was as a sergeant later. I left Paran to go to the CIB in 1978. So that was 5 years after joining the police force.
Yeah, that's very young.
But that was the average.
Was it?
At the time. Yeah,
okay.
I don't know what it is now, but that was the average. Mm. But again, the first place you went to as a detective was Russell Street, what they called the Bull Ring.
That's right, the Bull Ring.
Russell Street CIB. Mm. And all the squads were there at that time, of course, or most of them. And the first thing you wanted to do at the Bull Ring was to get out of the Bull Ring, either to get to a suburban division that might have been where you wanted to go or to a squad, although you had to usually spend a fair bit of time at a busy division before you could go to a squad.
Why did you want to get out? What was the Bull Ring? What is that? Is it just like a really competitive kind of...
Well, it was basically the city CIB.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of young men...
They just deal with basic crime around the city.
Yeah. But from the coppers, it sounds to me like a lot of young bulls, a lot of young men in there trying to prove themselves, very competitive environment, trying to prove themselves and get promoted essentially or move to the next level of where they want to be.
Well,
is that what it was like?
Yeah. More so, I think, is the reason that they might want to have gone to a detective's division closer to home,
mm-hmm.
perhaps.
Yeah.
Or
so
to
everyone's
a squad.
Trying to get out of there, basically, in terms
normally
of
you had to go to a division for a while before you went to a squad, and you would probably get... a broader range of experience at places like, or in any of the inner suburban stations or outer stations, maybe Frankston, Dandenong, Preston, Broadmeadows.
Yeah. Broadmeadows gets brought up all the time.
Where
yeah,
you would get a broader range of experience than just around the city. So there are different reasons for people wanting to leave the Bull Ring. But it was interesting. I mean, you wouldn't do it these days, but they used to have what was called a view room in the morning. And the view room was a room, it was like a little theatrette with sort of wooden bench seats at different levels facing the stage. And there'd be lights on the stage. And all the detectives from Russell Street, the squads and the Russell Street CIB, would go over in the mornings to have a view of who was arrested overnight. So the head of the consorting squad would stand up there at the lectern and give a full resume of this person. And
the actual person was
the
on
actual
stage.
Person was brought out,
oh, no
put, under
way.
The, put under the floodlights.
No.
And if he didn't want to come, then there'd be a couple of consorting squad or breaking squad detectives who'd help him onto the stage. I mean, you imagine that these days. But that was the view room a couple of days
that's
a week.
That's outrageous. So, like, potentially...
Which was interesting.
Vic Pierce has walked out onto the stage and...
He probably would be more likely one of the ones that was assisted. But
yeah, and so everyone's just sitting there. Why? Just to see if any of you blokes looking for Vic for any reason, because he's here.
Just to let you know who's been... You know, the consorting squad then were monitoring criminals and
yeah.
See who was mixing with who, and we had consorting laws, and if people were associating, undesirables associating with other undesirables, then if they're doing it too often, then that was an offence. So, yes. Things were more controlled than probably they are now.
Yeah, because like they haven't actually committed a crime is what you're saying. All they've done
The ones that were brought into the view room had been in the cells overnight.
Yeah.
They would have been arrested for something overnight.
Yeah, but consorting
but
in
consorting
and of itself
was
wasn't...
Consorting was just associating with
yeah.
with other criminals repeatedly.
So it's just intelligence gathering a lot. They're just like working out who's who and who's
familiarise yourself with people.
Sounds it's kind surveilling of exciting. People.
Who's who in the zoo?
Who's who in the zoo?
Who the players are?
Yeah, it's surveilling people, which today would not be legal, but it's would it?
Probably from a rights perspective, you wouldn't be able to put people up like that in that sort of fashion these days.
But you could still get around and kind of just keep your eye out on things. Like, do they still, the cops still do, I guess, surveillance, but consorting squad, what's that now?
Naturally, there's an interest in who's associating with who. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's just not called a consorting squad.
Yes,
no, different. The consorting squad and the breaking squad are long gone.
What's a breaking squad?
No, they used to look into safe breakers and that sort of thing. They used to work pretty closely with the consorting squad and, pickpockets at the races and all that sort of thing. But they're both very useful squads in their time, very effective.
I still don't understand I'm missing a link. So we've got Vic Pierce on the stage under the lights, but all the detectives looking at him. So how are we what's it got to do with consorting? So are we saying we arrested him with Emily Webb? Did you guys know he hangs out with Emily Webb? Is that the purpose? Is that what the
they'd read out what he had been arrested for.
Just so everybody
who
knows.
Who he was with, what his criminal history was.
Yep. Just to get it clear in everyone's minds, this particular incident.
All education.
Yes, I see. Okay, so that then next Monday when we arrest him again or another bloke for a separate issue, we're joining the dots on who's who and all the connections.
Recognise him when you're out on the street and, you know, what areas he might frequent. And
see.
Sounds a bit like a handover when nurses hand over to the next
patients.
Shift. Yeah, handover.
I understand. So that's how people become very known to police, isn't it?
I mean, we're talking a long, long time ago.
I wonder who the frequent actors on the stage were for the View.
It's always the same names, though. I mean, even we know that. It seems like every story you tell, certainly from those couple of decades, one of the most famous, this is what made me laugh before when you said your claim to fame, Roland, was being the last guy to direct the traffic at the intersection. And the first thing that popped into my mind was the photo of you escorting Mr. Rentakill up the stairs to court. And I thought, I don't know if the traffic directing is your claim to fame. You have been involved in some of the biggest cases in Australian crime in modern history. And that photo of you escorting him is extraordinary.
The one with the party hat or the one?
No, that was the, I know. I know it was used for as an invitation to a party later. For Roland, not for Mr. Rentakill. Christopher Dale Flannery, also known as. You can see a copy of that photo, the one without the party hat, on our Facebook and Instagram pages. And next week on Australian True Crime, you'll hear more from Roland Legg when we discuss a couple of his most intense cases, including the murders of Lauren Barry and Nicole Collins, also known as the Bega Schoolgirls, and the harrowing case of Jaden Leskey. That's next week on Australian True Crime. Thank you to our guest, Roland Legg, who still has many stories in the tank for our live show at the Yarraville Club on April 8. Extra tickets have been released. Check the show notes and our Facebook page for the link. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.